Welcome to the Molding Private Practice Show, where we help healthcare practitioners in private practice keep true to their purpose and build a life of mastery by providing the knowledge, skills, and tools to bring their dreams to life. In this episode of the show, we speak to Francesca Moresi about being a psychotherapist and psychologist and everything private practice management related. Francesca Moresi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Oliver.
So glad to have you on board.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, in this episode, we're going to be talking about you being a psychotherapist, psychologist, and clinical psychologist in the UK and in Italy. So very honored to have you on board. Thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
So my question always to introduce this, you know, this episode or this show is to ask practitioners. So, you know, when you're little, adults always seem to find delight in asking you the question, you know, what do you want to do when you grow up? So did a young Francesca say that you want to be a psychologist?
No, I want to be a cashier at the superstore, at the supermarket. I love that. Or actually, I wanted to work in a bookstore or at the library. That was my dream growing up. But then I don't know what happened. When I was in high school and I had to choose university, I just knew that I had to go into psychology. And people were asking me, why? Why? I had no answer. I just knew. And they said to me, but what if you fail the test? And I said, I'm not going to fail the test. That's my only option. So, you know, that will be it. And so it was.
Wow. That actually tells me so much about your personality and how you approach things. Very determined, I suppose. Eh? And I think you have to be to be a psychologist. You really have to be. Would you agree with something like that?
I would agree because, you know, at least where I trained in Italy, it's been a journey that lasted 11 years. So that's, you know, you have to be quite determined to actually go through all of it. Mm. And I did it all in a row because I just felt, you know, that's what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to become a psychotherapist. So I did it straight away after my master's degree. So it was a long 11 years, but beautiful and very rewarding.
Wow. I just want to repeat that. So, because that's, like I told you, this is one of the reasons, you know, we're doing this show is to point people, you know, especially aspiring healthcare practitioners, aspiring psychotherapists, to really understand how much of time you're giving up. Because, you know, most people, they always refer to medicine. You know, they always say, you know, being a doctor is such a long time. But 11 years is a long time in terms of journey to when you can actually start practicing or go into and find a job and stuff like that. And that's, you know, is a lot of determination.
Yeah. And of course, you know, after my master's, I did a bachelor degree, then a master's degree. And after that, I started to work, support myself during, you know, the last part of the training. But yeah, it was long, it was intense, and it could be a little different in the UK. I'm not sure about that. This, though, is the path in Italy.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, 11 years sounds more, but I know in South Africa, for instance, it's 7 or 8 years. So irrespective, you know, it's not quite a 3 or 4 year degree and then you in the working world, you know, and so it's definitely quite a journey. And The other thing I always get with, especially psychologists, but it seems to be the same with the other healthcare practitioners, is that it's quite a process to get selected, you know, to become a psychologist. And then the other one with psychologists that comes up a lot is that it's quite a process to get into a master's program because there's obviously limited spaces. Did you find that as well?
Well, yeah, we had selections both at the bachelor and the master degree. Yeah.
Okay. And there's limited spaces and, you know,
limited spaces. I think once you're in the system, because again, Italy is slightly different, but nonetheless, yes, you have to do a test and you can access further education only if you are successful. Yeah.
Okay. Brilliant. So when you were qualified, did you practice in Italy first and then moved over to the UK?
Yes, I did practice. So at the very beginning, I worked as an occupational psychologist. So basically, I was hired from a consultancy firm and I was delivering work-related stress education in organizations, and I was doing groups as well, and I was listening to people's problems in the organizations. And on the side, I started as well to work with a few private clients as a psychologist. And in the meantime, I was also studying to become a psychotherapist. So as part of that training, I was doing an internship at the hospital here in Como. And so I was working both with individual clients and with a group. That was a beautiful experience, yes.
Okay, really nice.
It gave me the opportunity to actually, you know, see many different things at the same time and understand also what was, you know, my main area of interest.
I think that's also like when you start working in the field, it makes it a lot more real as well. I think, you know, the one term that comes up a lot with psychologists that is the whole imposter syndrome. You know, like you don't feel as confident in terms of what you're doing. But, you know, you have to go through it anyway, and that's how you become better at it and stuff like that. Did you find that when you started working?
Well, yeah, at the beginning, you know, it can be quite frightening because, you know, people come to you and you're like, okay, I'll do what I've been told to do. But, you know, it's like starting anything new is just, you know, you don't know how it's going to be. And so, of course, experience is everything.
Yeah. It must be quite unnerving as well, especially if it's like a much older person, you know, coming for therapy or, and you know, they're obviously looking to you for, you know, direction and stuff like that. And
I remember that at the very beginning, I used to do a lot of meditation and a lot of breath work before every session, just to literally ground myself and be there present instead of just worrying about, oh my God, what am I gonna say?
Yeah, no, that's true. And people judge us, you know, like they're coming in and they see, you know, this really young person, you know, they're obviously in their minds, you know, it's trying to, you know, put it together. It's like, is this person gonna help me? And I think the other thing with practitioners is there's nowhere to hide. You know, in corporate, you could be in a meeting with other people and, you know, you could deflect a little bit and stuff like that. But when you're in that therapy space, you just one-on-one, you know, like the other person is right there. And so there's no way to go.
But the feedback I got from my experience is that when you are there for someone, even if at the beginning, you know, they can be doubtful, they can notice your age, if you're there and you're compassionate and you are real, people get that and people trust you.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, I think that's and it's amazing how quickly, you know, people start to, you know, to build that trust as well. I think the one practitioner actually told me, like, she was so relieved when the person came back, you know, because they can make the appointment, you know, but you're not sure if they're going to come back, you know, the next week, because there's nothing holding them to come back. Like, you know, they could just say, I'm not coming back. But, absolutely, you know, the fact that they come back is like a reassurance that obviously you did something well in the first one.
Yes. Yes. In the beginning. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Going back to that moment of the psychology, you know, choosing the field, though, was there no spark, or was there, you can't remember exactly what was it that actually made you choose psychology?
In fairness, I just knew it. You know, I mean, I was not spiritual at the time, not at all. However, you know, I developed that aspect of my life later. But it's as if, you know, I felt guided. I couldn't express it in these words at the time, but if I look at it in hindsight, I recognize it's as if someone told me that's what you got to do. And I trusted what at the time I felt it was a gut feeling. I just knew. Of course, you know, I remember when I studied philosophy in high school, I found Freud's theories very interesting. I knew I liked that. So there was, you know, a bit of knowledge, but I just knew that was my path.
Wow.
And I hope, I mean, it's not very elaborate or anything, but
no,
it is.
Perfect. Yeah, yeah. No, it's pretty profound. I mean, I normally find, and you're the first person that, you know, it's as deep as that. But, you know, normally there's a spark from someone, you know, maybe they did like a, you know, like a job shadowing, or they were, you know, they did an assessment and, you know, they said, okay, you know, you're much more suited to this profession kind of thing. But I think, you know, your story collaborates everyone else, which is once they decided, they knew that that was it. You know, like it was like almost that resonance, you know, the gong and the meditation bowl. It was that. Okay, amazing. And in terms of being a psychologist, I suppose after being a psychotherapist, especially in the UK, was there a moment that you decided you actually didn't want to work in a corporate setting or anything like that, you wanted to go into independent practice?
Yeah, I always knew that as well.
It's the cashier thing.
In the sense that when I decided, you know, this is my path and I am indeed going to become a psychotherapist as well, I always wanted to work one-to-one with clients. Look, I've always been terribly fascinated by the clinical work. And as I mentioned before, I also had some experience in the occupational field, which to an extent I liked, and I still like to provide trainings, for example. I like that educational aspect to the profession, and that's something that I also incorporate in my clinical work, right? I always help people understand. But ultimately, I'm fascinated by the clinical work, and I knew that I also wanted the freedom to act as I believe it's best for my clients. And therefore, I just wanted to work for myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I mean, like you mentioned, you know, like about the cashier in the supermarket, it's almost like it's your terms, you know, it's your yes. thing, you know, these the entrepreneurship kind of aspects, you know, to it as well, which is actually quite nice. That you realize that. I think many practitioners, I think, I wouldn't say get forced into it, but, you know, they go into private practice or independent practice and they don't realize how much of a shift that is in terms of, you know, finding your clients, billing your clients, you know, making sure you get paid, all of those kind of things, which is, you know, which is difficult. But did you find that that came quite easy, or did you, you know, like the admin part of private practice?
Yes and no, in the sense that I knew this was a part of it, and I'm really lucky because, you know, my husband is very supportive, he's very good at that, and he taught me a lot of things. And I've been an advocate for a long time about the fact that I believe that when we train to become therapists or psychologists, we should be trained as well on how to open your own private practice. And that's why when I moved to London before I actually built my practice, I found some courses. There was something, I don't know if it's still there, it's called an Unruliversity, I think. If I remember correctly, it was many years ago, 10 or 11 years ago. And they provided free education on many different subjects. And I remember, you know, picking and choosing everything that was related to me, like, for example, you know, how to advertise yourself, how to create your own website, how to make a business plan, and so on and so forth. But I had to learn a lot about all of this. And so I would definitely encourage anyone who wants to have a private practice to study all of that, because it's very crucial that you learn how to do it.
Okay, that's really good advice. You know, someone else said it nicely. It's like almost like you really have to, you know, like with like understanding your clinical work, you almost like have to find a real interest about the other stuff, like the marketing and the admin and all of that stuff. You really have to, you know, understand it. You mentioned business plan as well. You know, people have to understand how to do that. Why is the business plan important? And I suppose a business plan is like, you know, it is a plan, just like a life plan, you know, like you help your clients through. So it's almost like a plan for yourself, you know, with that private practice, which is it's a really nice way to, you know, to think about it too. And was there any particular challenges that you found, you know, with private practice that you would almost like, you know, tell others, you know, like, you know, watch out for that, or, you know, like, you know, make sure you do this?
Well, let me think. Well, I think everyone, well, should have a therapy agreement, right? Mm-hmm. To explain clients' privacy, confidentiality, the extent of it, but also, you know, to set the rules of the setting, mm-hmm. cancellation policy. I remember when I was renting a room in a particular place, they would also ask, for example, for credit card details, just to make sure that practitioners were protected in case of, you know, last minute cancellation. So there are things that we can do to try and protect ourselves. That's not something that I do now because I trust my clients enough to not to do that. But I think we just need to watch out to those aspects that are basically our weak spot, I believe, right? And it can be different from everyone.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. It's interesting, as you mentioned, that, you know, the trust aspect as well, and the credit card, because I find that's something, you know, obviously practitioners are not, I would say it's not one of their strongest points, you know, asking for money and, you know, making sure that you get paid and putting a different hat on it. You know, I think because when you have to do that, especially if you have to, you know, do a reminder saying, you know, you haven't paid for last month or last session, that's normally a difficult conversation, a different conversation.
Yeah.
A therapist conversation.
Yes. And I know that some therapists really struggle, for example, with asking for money. And, you know, sometimes admin can take a really long time. So you just need to understand how it fully works so that you can take into account all aspects of a private practice.
Okay, that's really good. And in terms of your, you know, in the Molding Health Show, we spoke about pranayama and breath work and changing the narrative. Have you found that when you started private practice, you started with those particular interests, or did they kind of evolve as you went through private practice?
Well, some of them definitely evolved. And they also evolved not only because of my practice, but also because of my personal interest and in the fact that I was trying to change the way I felt. And so I used to do a lot of pranayama at the time, a lot of yoga, and that's how I understood the link and I brought it in, basically.
Okay, nice. And in terms of those areas of interest, is there, I mean, like if someone wanted to say, I really, you know, love Francesca's story and I would like to model my private practice around that, is there anything that you would say, you know, they need to work on? Are there special tools or anything like that that they need to have?
Well, I strongly believe that the more work we do on ourselves, the better, in the sense that as therapists, we're constantly triggered, right? Because people are very challenging, because there are a lot of emotions in the room, sometimes there's silence in the room, or sometimes, you know, they may talk about something that we are also experiencing, whether it's a divorce or a loss or anything really. And so we need to be very equipped, prepared to protect ourselves, but also to protect our clients. I think it's coming back to ethics. It's very ethical to work on ourselves so that we can actually protect ourselves and the clients and deliver the best treatment. Because if we are triggered and we don't know it, it'll be messy. And that's why, you know, another important suggestion would be regular supervision. It's mandatory, by the way, if you, for example, are registered with the BACP, like I am, but it's a good reminder, you know, regular supervision, do your own therapy. That's very essential to me.
Okay, that's really, I mean, I think you're one of the few that have mentioned it in those terms, but I agree with you.
I'm sorry to hear that, you know, because we should all do the work.
I think it's more, I mean, the sense I got, it's more like optional, you know, but I think you're the first person that said, you know, it's almost, I would say, use the stronger words in terms of saying it's almost ethical, you know, to do it.
I think so. Because, that's my personal opinion. And in fact, you know, in Italy, I'm not sure now, I don't know if anything has changed, but when I was doing my therapy training, it was mandatory, at least for my training school, it was mandatory 4 years of psychotherapy, 3 years individual, and the last one group therapy.
Yeah.
And I really like that.
I think within within the studies, I definitely came across it like that. But I think once you get into independent practice, it's like, you know, owning your own boss, I suppose. You know, you make up the rules. And yeah, so I think supervision and working on your own therapy, I think everyone agrees. But someone, another therapist said it quite nicely. It's like, you know, she said that it's almost like that's what you're advocating for other people. So almost like you need to be, you know, like walking that line as well, which is, which is a nice way to put it too.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
And is there anything around being, so the other trend I found, you know, with practitioners is that there's always someone like a guide, and maybe that was a supervisor, but helps you through those, that journey of going, you know, going into private practice. Did you have someone like that as well?
And not in private practice, but more in my personal journey. And these are definitely my therapists.
Okay.
My supervisor, she definitely helped me through the clinical part of it. But when it came to setting up my practice, it was just myself. And again, my husband, he was really supportive. So I don't feel that I had a mentor, if that's.
Yes.
No.
I use the word a guide, but you're a guide, mentor, and I found like with some of the therapists they would mention, you know, obviously it's not a long-term thing, but someone just appeared or, you know, like helped them through that one, you know, stage. And sometimes it's as you said, you know, it was just a supervisor or your own therapist, you know, helping you with that.
To me, I think I was okay with the setup, but it was more about having someone mentoring me on the clinical side, just to make sure that, again, I was delivering good stuff to my clients. I was more concerned with that ethical / clinical part.
Okay. And in the UK, is there like a special, I mean, are there premises that you have that you... Obviously, you know, there's a lot more online work now, especially after COVID.
Yes.
But did you find that you had your own therapy rooms, like in a center or at your own property?
I had both, basically. I had both since the very beginning. When I started, I used to work in London, in central London, very close by to the tube station of Temple, just behind the justice, Court of Justice.
Okay.
And that was actually a very good marketplace because so many professionals were around that area, so many professionals that actually are insured. So that was a good place. But then I also rented a place in Kensington, and it was a beautiful, beautiful clinic. And at the time, I was also seeing someone from home, which is very, very common in the UK. You just have to have a nice setup as well there. Since COVID, I'm only working from home because all of my clients, but two, want to do online. So okay. I only have a couple of clients who wants to see me in person when I'm in London, and the rest of it is online.
Okay, that's brilliant. I mean, I think that's a consensus with, you know, most psychologists as well, which is actually, it's amazing for, you know, psychologists and, you know, to be able to have a, you know, to be able to work wherever you want to, you know, in terms of you know, just having the online abilities, which is really cool. And in terms of being a psychologist, is there, you know, if someone was standing in front of you and said, you know, I really want to do this, is there anything that you would tell them about being a psychologist or words of advice, you know, to be aware of?
As I said before, work on yourself.
Okay.
That's it. That is it. Because that really makes the difference, I believe.
Okay. I think... You know, from you know, I think the biggest thing is I want to get out is obviously, you know, with the patients, you know, how did you start working with that? You know, your studies, being in independent practice as well, you know, in the UK. Maybe one more is like around, you mentioned insurance. Do you find that insurance is a big aspect in the UK? I mean, like people need to have insurance in order to see a psychologist?
Well, you know, got to understand starting doing this work is that many people who work in a corporate environment have insurance as a benefit, right? And that makes things so much easier because very often different insurance companies make over the whole cost of the session. And so for people who, you know, maybe couldn't afford that privately, that's a huge incentive. So I work with a few insurance companies, and I have to say, most of the people I see them privately, but still I have, you know, a slice of my income comes from insurance companies. Yes.
Okay, brilliant. And,
so that could be, you know, a good advice to be registered with insurance companies.
Okay. So, and for the insurance companies, is there a different way that you submit your invoices to them? Or do you have to use a software to do that?
No, I mean, it depends. But yeah, you do submit your invoices directly to them. They approve and then they pay you. So, for example, yes, you have to know that payment gets a little bit delayed normally.
Mm.
So if I see you privately and I ask you, Oliver, you know, this is the bill for the month. So this is your invoice. I normally, you know, clients pay within the week. For insurance companies, it can be up to a month. So you just need to be aware of that.
I think that's similar to the other stories, especially in South Africa. South Africa's insurance is quite big as well.
Right.
And I think we always, you know, most clients, you know, we advise, you know, like, you know, you can't have it all as insurance clients or else obviously your, you know, payments are going to be delayed. But they normally have a split, you know, between private and insurance-based.
But once you get the pace, right? So, for example, even if all insurance companies pay you after a month, once you are, you know, in the pace of that, you'll get paid every month anyway. So it doesn't really change anything but the first period. So,
yeah, that's true. That's very true. I love this conversation. Is there anything around being a psychologist or private practice that you thought we didn't cover? I think we went through it quite quickly, but I think we covered everything that we needed to.
I think maybe one last thing, you know, we need to become aware of why we're doing it. And sometimes when we want to help people at all costs, we tend to overdo it. So that's why burnout is so common in this kind of professions. And I think that's also something that we need to be aware and protect ourselves from. And sometimes when we do our own work, that's when we understand why we need to help people so desperately and so badly. And sometimes that relates to our identity. And when we're able to change that, that's when we're actually able to deliver a better help, a help that is not about ourselves and our need to help people, but rather a more genuine help, a more centered, right, and balanced help. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It does perfectly, actually. I'm glad you mentioned that. Any particular strategies that you use that works?
Well, again, it's a lot of awareness.
Okay. Nothing as simple as just watching Netflix.
Okay. The point is, when you do the clinical work, as I said before, you are triggered. And the more you work and the more you know about yourself, the less trigger you are. But still, it's not that things keep happening. What changes is how much you're triggered and your ability to observe it rather than being dragged down from it by it. Does that make sense? So we need to be very good observers. We need to be very much aware of everything that happens in the room. That's so important.
Yeah. And I think, you know, going full circle back to the therapy, your personal therapy and supervision, that's why that plays a massive role too. Love this. Love meeting you and hearing your story. And it's always fascinating hearing those. But yeah, thanks so much for your time and thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you, Oliver, for having me. It's a pleasure.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening. As always, stay tuned and we'll speak to you in the next episode.